Amen. I've shared with you before my profound love for epic, and it has to be epic, not, 200-page epic, like epic sci-fi and fantasy novels. We're talking like 600 to 1,000-page stories. I love authors like Brandon Sanderson. This man, he creates masterful worlds with wonderful and amazing cultures and histories. He has characters with incredible complexities, plots that are moving and believable and sometimes downright shocking. I love his character development. I love character development in general when characters aren't static. Right? Often, some characters are just one-dimensional, and it's usually like the bad guy in a story. It's like the bad guy is just bad all of the time. The real world is far more nuanced than this. Just like rarely is a good guy good all the time. The truth is we're all a mixed bag, aren't we? A bag of good and evil. Sometimes at the same time, we often do good things for the wrong motivations, and sometimes we stumble in the wrong things, but our hearts are in the right place. Well, those of you who are millennials know you grew up with the show SpongeBob SquarePants. It's connected. It is a cartoon that follows the exploits of the extremely excitable and optimistic sea sponge, SpongeBob. His enthusiasm for life is simply fun. He's also utterly irresponsible. There's an amazing fan theory out there about the show, and it is that the seven main characters that you see on the screen there are each represent one of the seven deadly sins. SpongeBob is filled with lust for everything. That's why he's so excitable. Patrick Starr is sloth. He doesn't care to improve his life. Squidward is wrath. He's angry all the time at everybody. Mr. Krabs, of course, is greed. Sheldon Plankton is envy. He wants that, recipe for the Krabby Patties. Sandy Cheeks, I just got that, by the way, last night. Sandy Cheeks. What? I didn't know. I just realized what, yeah. Anyway, she's full of pride, and Gary the Snail eats all the time. Gary is gluttony. Well, I love the show's character development along these lines. It's a silly cartoon, don't get me wrong. It has largely absurd plot lines, but the characters truly do follow these tendencies, though not perfectly. Squidward, for example, even though he hates everyone, he is miserable, he is wrath personified, he's always angry, yet he's also extremely talented musically. The only time Squidward ever shows joy on the show is when he's playing music. See, I love when an author adds some complexity to a character. I like when a character is about something more than just the plot. See, there's an overarching theme to a good character. A character is as symbolic as he or she is actual. It's like, yes, in the story, the character is a real person engaging in real activities, yet the character represents something more. I love that part of story writing. The character is larger than himself or larger than herself in the role that individual plays in the story. Well, Gideon is one of those characters. Yes, Gideon was a real man in a real time, in a real place. Yes, the things written about Gideon really did happen. Yet Gideon's character is much larger than Gideon. You see, at the same time he's a real man with real weaknesses and real strengths, he has real faith and real doubt. He's also a stand-in for us because our faith is both real and not real, right? You've heard the story with the man who said to Jesus, "Lord, I believe, help my unbelief." Gideon is a real-time embodiment of this. In real ways, Gideon represents Israel, and he represents us, he represents the priesthood, and he represents the king who is coming. We're in Judges 8 this morning. In our text, we're going to see Gideon change, almost in real time. And we're going to see where I believe he went wrong, and that has a warning and an encouragement for us today. Judges chapter 8, verse 1. Then the men of Ephraim said to him, "What is this that you have done to us, not to call us when you went to fight against Midian?" And they accused him fiercely. And he said to them, "What have I done now in comparison with you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the grape harvest of Abiezer? God has given into your hands the princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeeb. What have I been able to do in comparison with you?" Then their anger against him subsided when he said this. And Gideon came to the Jordan and crossed over, he and the 300 men who were with him, exhausted yet pursuing. So he said to the men of Succoth, "Please give loaves of bread to the people who follow me, for they are exhausted, and I am pursuing after Zeba and Zalmunna, the kings of Midian." And the officials of Succoth said, "Are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hand, that we should give bread to your army?" So Gideon said, "Well then, when the Lord has given Zeba and Zalmunna into my hand, I will flail your flesh with thorns of the wilderness and with briars." And from there he went up to Penuel and spoke to them in the same way. And the men of Penuel answered him as the men of Succoth had answered him. And he said to the men of Penuel, "When I come again in peace, I will break down this tower." Now Zeba and Zalmunna were in Karkor with their army, about 15,000 men, all who were left of all the army of the people of the east, for there had fallen 120,000 men who drew the sword. And Gideon went up by the way of the tent dwellers east of Nob and Jogbeha and attacked the army, for the army felt secure. And Zeba and Zalmunna fled, and he pursued them and captured the two kings of Midian, Zeba and Zalmunna, and he threw all the army into a panic. Then Gideon, the son of Joash, returned from the battle by the ascent of Heres. And he captured a young man of Succoth and questioned him. And he wrote down for him the officials and elders of Succoth, 77 men. And he came to the men of Succoth and said, "Behold, Zeba and Zalmunna, about whom you taunted me, saying, 'Are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hand, that we should give bread to your men who are exhausted?' And he took the elders of the city, and he took thorns of the wilderness and briars, and with them taught the men of Succoth a lesson. And he broke down the tower of Penuel and killed the men of the city. Then he said to Zeba and Zalmunna, 'Where are the men whom you killed at Tabor?' They answered, 'As you are, so were they. Every one of them resembled the son of a king.' And he said, 'They were my brothers, the sons of my mother. As the Lord lives, if you had saved them alive, I would not kill you.' So he said to Jether, his firstborn, 'Rise and kill them.' But the young man did not draw his sword, for he was afraid, because he was still a young man. Then Zeba and Zalmunna said, 'Rise yourself and fall upon us, for as the man is, so is his strength.' And Gideon arose and killed Zeba and Zalmunna, and he took the crescent ornaments that were on the necks of their camels." It's important for us to remember the story up to this point. Then if we can do that, I think we'll be able to understand more clearly what is happening in Gideon. Right? Israel, as we know, sinned against God by worshiping false gods. Think of that. Rather than trust in the one who rescued them from Egypt, the one who performed miracles for them in the wilderness, who protected them during 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, the one who gave them the land of Canaan, the one who caused the walls of Jericho to fall down, the one who promised them blessings and prosperity, instead of worshiping that one, they worship the Baals in pursuit of the same prosperity God promised them. Because of this, God allowed the Midianites to oppress them. Now remember, the aim of this oppression was not to harm Israel. God was not seeking to harm his people. God wanted to bless them. He wanted to grant them prosperity and peace. But he knows this peace does not come from the Baals, and it does not come from the Asherah, so he disciplined his people that they might return to him in faith and repentance and receive those blessings. Well, after 7 years of having their crops stolen by the Midianites and having their flocks and herds stolen by the Midianites, God appeared to Gideon and called Gideon to be the deliverer of Israel. We've seen that Gideon was fearful. He doubted his own ability to lead. God assured him the victory was actually his. It was God's victory. God was going to give the victory to Gideon. He doesn't have to earn it. God is going to give him the victory. God would use Gideon to bring it about, to drive out the Midianites along with their allies, the Amalekites and the people of the east, but God was the one who was going to give him the victory. Gideon still wasn't ready. After God told him he would use him to rescue Israel from their oppression, Gideon wasn't convinced. Remember, he protested that he was just Gideon, right? The least in his father's house. Besides, he said, the Lord has forsaken his people. That's why they're in the mess they're in to begin with. Completely forgetting how Israel had sinned, though the evidence of it was everywhere, including in his father's own household. So God had to build him up, right? God had to change him by strengthening his faith. Remember, one day God appeared to him as a man. Gideon didn't yet know who he was, so he offered him a meal. God touched that meal with the staff he was carrying. He caused the rock it was placed upon to burn up and turned that meal into a sacrifice. Gideon then built an altar to the Lord. Later that night, having built him up in his faith a bit, God instructed him to tear down his father's Asherah pole and his father's altar to Baal. He was to use the wood from the Asherah pole as firewood to offer as a sacrifice one of the two bulls he would use to pull down this massive altar. You remember, Gideon obeyed the Lord in tearing down the altar and making the sacrifice, but he did it at night so no one else would see him do it. Still, the next day, the men of the city were so angry at the loss of their community worship site that they were ready to murder Gideon. And yet, God protected him using his father and his power. Well, Gideon still wasn't convinced, so he pleaded with the Lord for a sign. God granted him a sign. The fleece was dry when the ground around it was covered with dew. But then the Lord offered him yet another sign. God gave him a further bit of evidence that he was going to do exactly as he promised he would do. So Gideon crept into the Midianite camp where he overhears a man sharing his dream about a barley loaf, a little loaf of bread, knocking over a tent in the middle of the Midianite camp. And the guy he tells it to is like, look, let me interpret this dream. That loaf of bread is Gideon. Gideon is going to whoop our butts. He's going to win. He's going to overturn our entire camp. It's over for us. Gideon's initial response was to worship the Lord for the kindness of this sign and God's ongoing assurance of victory. By the time he recounted these events to his men later that night, his 300 men, suddenly the ensuing conflict was for the Lord and for Gideon. We see in this a very mixed bag for Gideon. He was fighting for the Lord, but some part of him was also fighting for Gideon, right? Now, still, we see that his battle plan was not really a plan for battle, but a plan for worship. His men would light torches in one hand and play trumpets in the other hand. This was, as they would do this, worshiping the Lord as the Lord fought for Israel. In the confusion and in the fear sent by the Lord, we saw that the Midianites and the Amalekites and the people of the east fought themselves and did most of the damage in defeating their massive coalition army. Only then, when it was obvious the battle was being decided, that Gideon called out more Israelites from the northern tribes to fight for Israel, including the tribe of Ephraim. As we saw last week, the men from Ephraim pursued the two Midianite princes, Oreb and Zeeb. They captured them, and they executed these men, and they chopped off their heads and brought the heads to Gideon and threw them at his feet. Then we come to our text. Verse 1 picks up right when the Ephraimites arrive with the heads of Oreb and Zeeb. They're angry that they weren't called out to battle for the initial fight. But the truth is, most of the tribes weren't called, right? Only the people from the northernmost tribes were called. In fact, of the 32,000 men who showed up to fight, most of them were sent back home by the Lord himself. God's plan was to rescue Israel with just Gideon and 300 men. God didn't intend for any other men to fight in a battle. Now, we saw that they didn't actually go home. They merely returned to the army camp, to their tents that were nearby. Well, after God sent the Midianites running, and after God caused such fear among them that they were killing each other, Gideon sends a message and he calls out those soldiers to engage in the battle by pursuing the fleeing enemy. Well, the men of Ephraim are angry that they were not called out as part of that initial group. Now, part of it, you can understand it because ancient Near East was an honor-shame culture. If you're not honored, you are being shamed, right? You get one or the other. There's no neutral ground there. Besides, the people of Ephraim were in a particularly vulnerable location within Israel. They're sort of right in the central. If you wanted to attack all Israel, you would attack in the middle and divide the northern tribes from the southern tribes. If the tribe of Ephraim were perceived as being weak, they would be vulnerable to attack. So they wanted to show how strong they really were. And when they arrived where Gideon was, they blasted him over this, right? Over Gideon's failure to let them in on the action earlier. It's curious that Gideon doesn't tell them that all he did was play a trumpet during the battle. He seems to have left that part out. So he demonstrates, though, one of two things. He either shows incredibly wise leadership with how he deals with the men of Ephraim, or he shows masterful manipulation. Right? He's either very wise or he's very shrewd. Given it's hard to tell which, given the fullness of the text, but it's likely a little bit of both. Now, he offers them a simple comparison. He's like, look, what have I done in comparison to what you have done? I mean, Gideon has pursued enemy soldiers, but the men of Ephraim not only have captured some soldiers, they've executed two of the princes. This is a big deal. This is a great honor for the men of Ephraim. Now, these princes are men who would seek to regroup their forces and avenge their defeat and had they been allowed to live, and so they were executed. But consider with me Gideon's question. What have I done? What has Gideon done? Well, first, Gideon was called by God to a specific task. Gideon was then sanctified by God for that specific task. But that's not something Gideon did. That's something Gideon received. God did these things. Gideon stood with his 300 men and worshiped the Lord by holding up torches in their left hand and playing trumpets in their right hand. What has Gideon done? Gideon has faithfully served the Lord as the Lord called him to do. But here he discounts faithfulness. He discounts it in order to make this comparison to boost the pride of the Ephraimites. See, while he and his 300 men from his clan, the Abiezrites, harvested, the men of Ephraim gleaned an even greater harvest. Gleaning is what you do after you harvest. You go and you pick up the leftovers. See, Gideon pursued, but they captured two princes. They were honored in battle while Gideon was merely chasing. He didn't do anything. He acknowledges in verse 3 that God is the one who had given these princes into their hands, right? God is the victor here, even if he used the men of Ephraim for that victory. But in doing this, Gideon's overlooking a significant fact. Of the 135,000 Midianites and Amalekites and people of the east who assembled for war in that valley, 120,000 have already fallen. They didn't fall because the trumpets were played so badly. The men of Ephraim captured two men. God defeated 119,998. By emphasizing their honor in battle, hear me, he was defusing a very volatile situation. Like, these men had been very angry with him. To make this emphasis, however, he discounted the incredible act of God in delivering them when Gideon's 300 trumpeters sounded the call to worship. See, Gideon realizes that what he has done doesn't result in his glory, but in God's glory. He's forgetting that this was the very purpose for reducing his army to just 300 men. Now, it was wise to defuse the anger of these men of Ephraim. It was a dangerous situation, but he did so in a way that robbed God of his glory, even as he claimed God's role in defeating Oreb and Zeeb. You see, listen, honoring the Lord is so much more than merely saying the right things. You're not honoring the Lord simply by mentioning him in a conversation. Gideon's entire demeanor, his actions and his words, his attitudes and his desires, these are all components of serving the Lord in a way that honors him. By demeaning his act of worship, the thing God called him to do, and his faithful obedience, he's actually robbing God of his full glory. See, too often we think of like faithful ministry, faithful service, as ministry that is big and exciting and successful. You know what faithful service is? Faithful service to the Lord is service that is faithful. It's been all week. We are not called to success in serving the Lord. We are called to faithfulness in serving the Lord. The Lord is responsible for any success we might have out of our activities for him. We're called to serve faithfully. He's the one who causes crops to grow. The outcome of the battle was only ever in the Lord's hands. No matter how clever Israel's battle plan was, no matter how hard they fought, whether Gideon defeated Oreb and Zeeb or the men of Ephraim defeated Oreb and Zeeb, God was the victor. In fact, the author of Hebrews describes this victory in terms of faith, right? After writing chapter 11 all about various men and women throughout history who had great faith, the author of Hebrews described that it was God who was faithful. Like the whole point of being, or God who was victorious, the whole point of faith is that it's not you, it's the one you're trusting in. So after listing several men and women, the author wrote this. He said, "What more shall I say? For time would fail me to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith," not their military prowess, not their clever battle plans, not their strength of character, not their leadership, "who through faith conquered kingdoms, enforced justice, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword. They were made strong out of weakness, became mighty in war, put foreign enemies to flight." Through faith, Gideon put foreign enemies to flight. See, faith necessarily points away from yourself and to the Lord. This is why faith honors the Lord. This is why saying with your mouth what your heart doesn't actually believe is not really honoring the Lord. It's just words. Gideon is a mixed bag. Yes, he responds in faith, but he keeps pulling back just shy of truly honoring the Lord. In verse 4, he's calmed down the men of Ephraim with his words. Gideon crosses the Jordan River in pursuit of the fleeing army of the Midianites. Now notice what the author says compared to what Gideon himself is going to say. The author says, he and the 300 men who were with him, exhausted and pursuing. You can't tell in English, but in Hebrew the words exhausted and pursuing are plural, meaning they must apply to both Gideon and the 300. Right? In other words, Gideon and the 300 are exhausted, and Gideon and the 300 are pursuing. Together, they stop at a city called Sukkot. They're in Israelite territory still. He gets there and he asks the men of the city for loaves of bread. This actually makes sense. You got to understand, this is not later that same night. Right? It's not like just a couple hours earlier, they broke the jars, the torches flared to light, they're blowing the trumpets. I mean, some time has passed. They have traveled many, many miles in pursuit of the fleeing army. Asking for bread is reasonable. The army's hungry. We got to have food to eat so we can keep running and pursuing. But notice what Gideon says in verse 5. So he said to the men of Sukkot, "Please give loaves of bread to the people who follow me, for they are exhausted, and I am pursuing after Zeba and Zalmunna, the kings of Midian." The author said Gideon and the 300 men are exhausted in pursuing. Gideon says, well, the 300 are exhausted, but I'm pursuing after them. I'm not going to let a little bit thing like exhaustion stop me. See, we saw that he claimed the battle was for the Lord and for Gideon. We ought to start questioning how much of this was for the Lord and how much was actually for Gideon. Now, he says he's pursuing two specific men, Zeba and Zalmunna. Why? Now, they're almost out of Israelite territory. These men are fleeing. They're close to their homes. Why is he pursuing these two men in particular? We're about to find out. So Gideon and his men need some food because they, all of them, are exhausted, yet they, all of them, continue their pursuit. But the officials of Sukkot aren't willing to intervene. I mean, if Gideon wins against these two kings, great. But if he loses, well, that's a problem. They will be attacked. They're on the frontier, right? They will be attacked first in retribution for helping Zeba and Zalmunna's enemies. There's no doubt that they question whether Gideon and his 300 exhausted men stand much of a chance. It's likely that they saw Zeba and Zalmunna march through earlier that day, and they saw how many people they had. So their answer is simple. Those men aren't in your hands yet, so neither is our bread. Then in verse 7, we see again Gideon's faith. He says, when, not if, when the Lord has given them into my hands. He's certain of victory here, isn't he? "I will flail your flesh with thorns and briars." When we first met Gideon, remember, he was flailing wheat, pounding wheat to break the kernels from the stalks. He was flailing wheat in a wine press out of fear. He was hiding. He was essentially hiding what he was doing for fear of someone coming along and stealing his wheat, his small harvest. But now he's threatening to flail his own countrymen for not giving him bread. You see, he has faith when the Lord has given me victory, but then he has something that's not faith. He expresses great confidence in the Lord, that the Lord will give him victory, but then he says he's going to get his revenge on his countrymen for their disrespect. Could it be that Gideon feels a bit of a sting from his encounter with the men of Ephraim? See, then he was merely chasing. He hadn't caught anybody. They had captured and killed two princes. He had to acknowledge they had more glory in battle at that point than he had. He doesn't tell them, but he knows, all I've done is play a trumpet and start running. That's all I've done. The men of Sukkot remind him he is still chasing something. In verse 8, he continues. He has a similar experience at a town called Penuel. They said essentially the same thing. If he beats them, great. But if he loses, well, they'll be the first to suffer for it. They're on the frontier. This time he tells them very calmly, look, when I come again in peace, hear the faith. When I come in peace, when I come again, I'm not going to be running in fear. I'm not going to be worried about anyone coming up behind me, sneaking up, because I know I'm going to go and defeat them. So when I come, I'm coming to you in peace. Well, not for you. For you, I'm going to destroy your defensive tower that gives your city protection. Well, they continue the pursuit. Gideon and his 300 come upon Zebah and Zalmunna. They're in Karkor with all that remains of their army. And here's where we find out how big this army really was, right? Of the 135,000 soldiers, that is those who lay across the valley like locusts in number, only 15,000 remain. Gideon's army is still 300. We're told the Midianite army felt so secure this far from where they had fought that they didn't post any guards. They're really close to home. Surely the Israelite army didn't chase them that far. Yet, when Gideon attacked them, God once again stirred up fear in them, and they fled. This time, however, Gideon captures two kings. His hands are no longer empty. In verse 13, with these defeated kings in shackles, he begins his return home. On the way, he catches young men. He finds out the man's from Sukkot, and he has them write down all the chief men and leaders of the city. There are 77 men who are in charge in some level in that city. And when he came to the city, notice what he said. Verse 15. He came to the men of Sukkot and said, behold, Zebah and Zalmunna, about whom you taunted me, saying, are the hands of Zebah and Zalmunna already in your hand that we should give bread to your men who are exhausted? You hear the mocking tone in this? He says, hey, look what's in my hand now. I got the kings you guys have been living in fear of. Look who I am. But notice what really angered him. About whom you taunted me. Gideon felt disrespected. Gideon, the least in his father's house. The one who will still thresh wheat, but in secret. The one who will tear down his father's altar, but at night. By his own admission, Gideon was a nobody. But somehow these men failed to notice who he is, how important he is. You see, Gideon no longer thinks of himself as least in his father's house. Now he's somebody, and you better put some respect on his name. Like three of you might have caught that. In verse 16, the author tells us he takes these village elders and leaders and taught them a lesson. That is, he drug them outside the city. He had his men rip off their shirts, and he did teach them a lesson. He flailed their backs with briars and with thorns, all because they failed to show him the respect he was very obviously due. But then we come to verse 17. And he broke down the tower of Penuel and killed the men of the city. See, he wasn't content to merely destroy their primary defense, their tower. He killed their men. Remember the role of a judge in Israel. A judge imposed justice. Now, the justice is first seen in the judge rescuing them from foreign oppression. God has done this through Gideon. The Midianites, the Amalekites, the people of the east, they're no longer a threat to Israel. They no longer oppress Israel. Their army is utterly destroyed. They have fled or been killed. God did this through Gideon. Gideon, however, has chosen to oppress his own people because they wouldn't give him bread. He then turns to Zeba and Zalmunna. He's chased them for over 100 miles on foot. That's how far Karkor is. Over 100 miles on foot. Why? Why does he chase these men this far? The threat of that they pose is gone, long gone. Many miles earlier was gone. Why does he continue to chase after them? We find out in verse 18. He asks them a very specific question. Where are the men you killed at Tabor? Like, wait, what men? This is the first time we've heard of it. The author has waited until this point to reveal Gideon's motivation in pursuing these specific kings this far. Apparently, sometime before, probably in the previous 7 years, these kings invaded, like they did at harvest time, and they captured some men at Tabor and killed them. Zeba and Zalmunna reply with heavy sarcasm in response to the question. It's like, where are they? I don't know. But they certainly look like you, kingly. You can hear the mocking scorn in their words. Well, Gideon informs them why they resembled him. They were his brothers. Here we see his resolve in pursuing these men. Gideon is after revenge. This is why he whipped the men of Sukkot. He was in a rage. This is why he destroyed the tower at Penuel and killed their men. He was in a rage. These things were messages for the two kings who were in captivity at that point. They were shackles as they witnessed him do this. It's the very reason he chased him for over 100 miles. He tells them, if you hadn't killed my brothers, I would allow you to live. But because you killed my brothers, he swore an oath to the Lord that they will die. But then strangely, he tells his son to kill them. Not just any one of his sons, his firstborn son. Why would he ask his firstborn son to do it? We see for a man's son to succeed him as king, he has to prove himself worthy. And surely for his son to kill two kings, not two princes like the men of Ephraim, two kings of Midian, his son would be worthy to take over after him. His son Jether, however, was still young, probably a teenager. He was afraid, uncertain, lacking confidence. Sound familiar? Sounds a lot like Gideon when we first met him. His son refuses to kill these unarmed men. Then Zeba and Zalmunna, as they would, mock Gideon. They basically tell him, look, if you're man enough, do it yourself. You got to go after a kid to do it. You think you're somebody? You want to prove you're somebody? Come do it. So Gideon proves he's somebody, that he matters, that he's powerful, that he's worthy. So he kills these unarmed men who no doubt have their hands tied. And then the author tells us he takes the gold jewelry that was on their camels as signs of their status as kings. We've seen throughout this book that Gideon has received more assurance from the Lord than any of the other judges, probably more than the other judges combined. God has repeatedly told him that God would give him the victory, that God would deliver Israel through Gideon. Gideon's role was to worship God through it. He was to point others to the Lord and what the Lord was doing for Israel. That's why God reduced his army to less than 1/100 of what it had been. That Gideon and all Israel might know for certain it was the Lord who delivered them. But Gideon failed to see this. See, the truth is, Gideon was chasing something, and it wasn't really Zeba and Zalmunna. He was chasing them, but they were a means to an end. See, he was chasing something far greater in his mind. He was chasing meaning and significance. How many times had Gideon, probably the youngest son of his father, how many times had he dreamed of glory in battle with himself standing over the bodies of these two fallen kings? How many times had he dreamed of this, longed for this, to get revenge for his brothers? Gideon took his opportunity when it was presented him, only it wasn't the opportunity for his glory. You see, Gideon had stopped looking to the Lord and had begun looking to himself. Rather than the Lord God of Israel being the standard and being the one who offered an identity to his people, Gideon began to look to himself and he began to make comparisons to who he is now compared to who he had been then. He began to find meaning and significance in himself and in what he could do. But remember the very reason God said only 300 men can go to battle. Chapter 7, verse 2, the Lord said to Gideon, "The people with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hand, lest Israel boast over me, saying, 'My own hand has saved me.'" No longer is he the young man hiding in a wine press threshing wheat. No longer is he the fearful man acting secretly in the dark. Gideon recognizes how far he has come. Now he's the head of a powerful army. Small, but a powerful army that has just defeated an army 450 times larger. So for every guy in Gideon's army, there's about 450 enemies on the battlefield. You see, in comparison to the boy who worked in secret, he's come far. No longer is he empty-handed in battle. Now he has some accomplishments. Now he has a resume. Now he has a kill list. Now he's got some bona fides. Now he can say, "My own hand has saved me." You see, Gideon has changed, but only in emphasis. What we see here is Gideon's pride. Pride that has been with him from the beginning, from when he was flailing wheat in a wine press. He was full of pride. Now we tend to think of pride only from one particular perspective, but pride has two sides. Pride is either thinking too much of yourself, or pride is thinking of yourself too much. When we first met Gideon, his focus was entirely on himself. He was thinking of himself too much. He was thinking about who he is, his relative worth in the world. Everything was about him and his perspective. I mean, though he was from a great and powerful house, we know his dad was very influential and very, very wealthy and powerful. But he said he was the least in his father's household. That's kind of like Alice Walton, son of the late Sam Walton of Walmart fame, claiming she's the least in her father's house because she's only worth $96 billion and her surviving brothers all have more. Yeah, you're less wealthy than they are by a few billion bucks, right? What is first and foremost in Gideon's mind is Gideon. He thinks of himself too much. That's his pride. His focus is on what he has or what he doesn't have, on what he can do or what he cannot do. His focus should have been on the Lord. So what changed? Well, what changed is Gideon went from thinking of himself too much to thinking too much of himself. Now, this is the sort of pride we more readily recognize, right? The braggart, the guy who boasts all about himself all the time, the guy who he's just filled with a sense of his own importance and competence. This is the same pride that he had in the wine press, only it has shifted its focus. Rather than bragging about how pitiful he is, how weak and unimportant he is, he's now bragging about how great and important he is. How dare you not recognize who I am? I will flail your flesh for not recognizing who I am. I will kill you if you don't give me the honor and the glory that is mine. You see, Gideon didn't really change. He remains essentially unchanged. You see, pride is the opposite of faith. Faith looks outward toward the Lord. Faith recognizes who God is, and faith recognizes what God has done. Faith also acknowledges how God uses people to accomplish his purposes, but faith does not allow the focus to remain on the person. Faith always returns its gaze to the Lord. Listen, faith recognizes we have no righteousness. We have no claim on God. We have no grounds for boasting. Faith recognizes that God has placed a claim on our lives, a claim he paid for with his own blood. Faith acknowledges that God can do anything with us and through us without needing us to be great. Look, whatever God is doing in our church, whatever God is doing in your life, Whatever God is doing in our individual spheres of existence, let us always remember God is the one doing it. He's not doing great things because we're great. He's doing great things because he is great. We can acknowledge the ways in which he uses us without making it about us. You see, our gaze has to return to him. You know, the truth of the matter is God is the greatest author of all. He's writing an incredible story of this world. This world is happening exactly as God is determining it will happen. He is masterful. Each one of us is a character in God's story, but it is God's story. So, church, as the author of Hebrews tells us, let us run with endurance the race God has set before us, collectively as a church, smaller units as households, as individuals. Let us run with endurance the race God has set before us. But let's do so looking to Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. If we want to be men and women of faith, if we want to live lives of faithfulness to the Lord, then our lives must begin and end with Jesus. It's not about us.